MacCast, Tuesday, May 15th, 2012. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the show. You know, it's been a crazy week this last week for Apple and Mac news. It seems like there was just a ton of stuff in my feed. I had to go through a lot of articles and stuff like that, but there wasn't a whole lot going on. I think with the lead up to WWDC coming up here in just a few weeks, a lot of the news is kind of the same. It's a lot of rehash. But, you know, we go through like we do on the show and we filter through all of that and hopefully get down to the pertinent details that you need to know. That's kind of my goal when I'm trying to figure out the new stuff. And we have that. Plus, we've got a lot of great feedback and questions from you. I have a great conversation interview I did with David Sparks from Mac Power Users, Mac Sparky. We've had him on the show before. He does workflow stuff. He has a new book out and we talk to him about that, as well as he gives us a bunch of tips related to that book on going paperless and stuff like that. So we've got a lot of really good stuff to still get into, so stay tuned for that. But before we get into it, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know that summer's right around the corner, and I know many of you, myself included, are planning vacations. We're going to be going out of town, things like that, and Notebook is a really great tool that you can use to help with your planning, because you can put all the stuff related to your trip into a single document, into a single notebook file. And you can set up different sections for the different phases, different parts. So like your planning, your packing list, the activities that you might want to do when you get there, all the expenses, so you can keep track of how much you're spending or how much it's going to cost you. All those sorts of things can go into your notebook. And what's great is it's not just the text. You can put in hyperlinks to web pages. So your hotel or restaurants that you might want to go to, the Yelp reviews, places you want to visit. And all of those will link back from your notebook back into Safari or your browser so you can re-reference it. You can also throw in images. So if you want to have images of the places that you might want to go to and check out, you can put that along with the text. And you can copy and clip stuff in. You can type it in directly. You can organize it as lists, however you want to do it. You can even put check boxes for your packing list so you can make sure that you have all the items that you want to have when you go. And it goes even further, because when you're making your plans and you're doing rental car purchases and airfare and hotel and stuff like that, the PDF receipts that you get, you know, print the receipts out as PDFs and throw them in a notebook as well. You can embed them right into your notebook, and then you'll have them there in handy for reference. And you can even sync all of this stuff over to your iPad. If you have the iOS version of Circus Ponies Notebook, you can sync it through iTunes or through Dropbox, and then you'll have it right there as you're traveling, and it makes it quick and easy. It's just a really versatile application. You should really check it out. If you haven't tried it, they have a free 30-day trial. You can get it over at circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. So let's kick it off. Right after the show last week, I think Apple released the update to macOS 10.7.4. macOS 10 Lion got an update. Apple says that it resolves an issue where the reopen Windows when logging back in setting was always enabled, even though you might have unchecked it. It looks like now it actually remembers your last selected option. So if you've unchecked that, the next time you go to reboot, it'll continue to be unchecked. So I never really quite understood why. I just thought that was the default behavior. That's how silly I am. I just thought, oh, I always have to uncheck it. But no, it wasn't supposed to be like that, and that's fixed. So that's a welcome improvement. A couple of other improvements. It improves compatibility with certain British third-party USB keyboards. Addresses an issue that may prevent files from being saved to a server. That would be annoying if you ran into that one. And improves reliability of copying files over to SMB servers, Windows servers. So if you're doing Windows file sharing, there's some improvements over there. And it also has 26 security updates in it. So addresses a number of vulnerabilities and things like that. So you probably want to grab this update if you're running Lion. You can, of course, get it through the software update, through the system preferences, or you can head over to Apple's website at apple.com/support. Now, David Morgenstern over at AppleCore did note that there were a few issues for some users in upgrading, some real specific cases, but I thought I'd mention them just in case you fall into these groups. He says that some storage vendors have been reporting some issues with external SATA or RAID products. So if you use any of those, you might want to check with your vendor and make sure that your devices are compatible with the 10.7.4 update. And there was also some notes that some older non-Lion compatible software, so software that wasn't officially Lion compatible, but that was working on Lion, can break. So they specifically called out VMware version 2.0. VMware is currently on version 4 for Lion, so it's 4.2. So that's several generations back, but software like that could break. It seems to maybe be related to some of the security updates and patches, maybe related to Java. So if you're using some older software that you know wasn't Lion compatible but was just working, just be prepared that that might break. Something else that I discovered, a little bug after upgrading, it looks like Apple tried to update the inline audio player in Mail. So if you receive a Mail message and it has an audio attachment, and I get this because you guys send me great audio files, but I can normally play them, and it used to have the standard, what I call the old school QuickTime look, the QuickTime 7 look. It now looks like it has the more updated QuickTime 10 look, but the problem is that the player gets cut off on the right-hand side, so you can't access the volume controls, you can't see the playhead, the little scrubber actually scrolls off the edge of the screen. It will play the whole audio file once you start previewing it, but you don't have access to all the controls. So as a workaround, I've just been using the quick look functionality, and that just brings up all your audio player controls right in the full window if you use, you know, if you receive audio files in mail.app. So again, another specific little bug, but just something to note. And then a few days later, Apple actually released an update for Leopard, a two-generation-old version of the operating system, something they typically don't do, but this one was important because it does address security, a pair of security-related updates. They released Leopard Security Update 2012-003, and it disables any versions of Flash Player that did not include the latest security updates, and also gives you the option to go out and get the latest version from the Adobe website. And then they released the Flashback Removal Security Update for Leopard users, and that's an app you can download, and it will remove the most common variants of the Flashback malware. And if it finds Flashback already on your Leopard system, it'll also notify you of that and remove it. In some cases, it'll ask you to restart your computer completely to remove the Flashback software. So if you are running Leopard, you probably want to grab both these updates, the security update as well as the Flashback removal tool, and just run that and make sure that your Leopard installation is secure. So a couple of operating system updates from Apple this week. Also, Apple released an update for the Apple TV, Apple TV version 5.0.1. That's for second generation and third generation Apple TVs. It's available by going into the settings on your Apple TV, going into general, and then selecting the software update option. What it contains is a number of bug fixes and other improvements, including adding previews for movie and TV shows from the iTunes Store in HD. It also fixes an issue that caused some iOS apps to have trouble connecting via AirPlay. It improved reliability for home sharing connections and addresses an issue affecting Netflix login and navigation. There's also some updates and improvements addressing stability and performance. So you probably want to grab this one if you have a second generation or third generation Apple TV. Specifically, a number of you have said you have been having issues with AirPlay on your Apple TV devices. So hopefully this will fix that. I know I've helped a few people with troubleshooting. We've never really come to a great resolution, so maybe this is the patch that you need to grab, and it is available now. Looks like Apple is backing off a bit on the branding of 4G on the new iPads. Apple this week updated many of its new iPad pages on its site, changing the reference or the title that said iPad plus 4G over to simply say iPad plus cellular. Looks like the change is likely in response to some of the complaints and threats of lawsuits they've been getting in several countries where the new iPad actually doesn't fully support all of the local 4G LTE frequencies, so that causes a little bit of confusion. Now, Apple's original claim was that They made the branding because the label adhered to the current marketing standards set by the ITU. If you remember, some recent changes by that organization allowed for the faster HSDPA Plus networks to be classified as 4G. So Apple was saying it fell under that branding, which is why they went with it. I guess Apple decided that for this battle, they're going to just let it go because they did modify their international as well as U.S. websites. Now, the copy on a lot of the pages still references the device supporting 4G LTE. It's just no longer identified as iPad plus 4G in the actual naming portion. So you'll still see the 4G references, but definitely not as strong as they were before. If all of the rumor sites turn out to be accurate, it's looking like the next few weeks, and really the month of June, is going to be a massive month for Mac updates. It's been relatively quiet about the various Mac models and what's going to be happening, but now in the past month or so, with the lead up to WWDC, we're getting a lot of information, and it's seeming like Apple's going to throw everything at us all at once, so we might have a lot of Mac stuff to talk about in June. And I know a lot of you get frustrated, myself included, with the lack of Mac news from time to time, but this week we got a bunch. So Mac pros are still reporting to get an update. I know there's been a lot of question on whether or not Apple would move forward with the Mac Pro, but there are some reports now claiming that Apple will finally do that update in the June timeframe, right around WWDC. They reportedly are saying that Apple wants to use Intel's latest Sandy Bridge E Xeon processors for their update, so they should get a nice new processor bump. It's not sounding like there's going to be a bunch of design changes. I think this is going to be mostly internally. I would assume they'd also get Thunderbolt ports. Another big and consistent rumor we're hearing is that Apple is going to be moving with its next generation of Mac upgrades from AMD GPUs, graphics processors, to NVIDIA. They kind of flip-flop back and forth, and I think it has to do with whoever currently has the best technology and sort of the best deals that Apple can get on that. But the reports are saying that Apple is going to jump from the AMD GPUs to NVIDIA's new Kepler platform, which has been rolling out kind of slowly and has kind of had some supply constraints. So I'd have a few concerns there, but they're saying those are the GPUs that Apple's going to go with on the next generation Mac Pros. We haven't heard too many other bits or details of what Apple's going to do with the Mac Pro line, but just the fact that they might actually do an update, I think, is going to be welcome news for a lot of people. The iMacs are also reportedly going to get an update, and this would be a little bit more substantial. Most of the information has been coming from ABC News this week, and they say that the new iMacs would be significantly thinner thanks to some new displays and new display technology. And I would also assume that Apple's going to drop the optical drive finally in the iMac line. That's just my own assumption, but that would, I would imagine, allow them to slim them down a little bit more. But on the display side, the new iMacs are reportedly going to be featuring high DPI displays. The panels are supposed to remain glossy, but get some kind of new anti-reflective treatment. So they should be, there should be a lot less glare on those new iMac screens, and I think that's going to be a nice update as well. I hope they continue that trend if it works really well into the MacBook and MacBook Pro lines. In terms of the LCD panels going high DPI, there was some supporting evidence discovered by Apple Insider. They reported finding Retina resolution icons in the latest 10.7.4 update. They, I think, noted that there was a text edit icon that was 1024 by 1024 pixels, where the current resolution of icons, the maximum resolution, is 512 by 512 pixels. On the processor side, the iMacs are expected to feature the latest Core i5 and Core i7 Ivy Bridge processors from Intel. And some supporting evidence behind that is coming from a couple of different sources. Now, this could be faked, but reportedly there were some Geekbench benchmarks that showed up on their site that seemed to indicate an unreleased iMac model. It contained a 13.2 designation in terms of the model number, and reported that it had a quad-core i7 processor running OS 10 10.8 Mountain Lion at 3.4 gigahertz, and the machine itself reportedly received a Geekbench score of 12,183. And as I mentioned earlier, it is expected that Apple will replace the AMD GPU in the new iMacs with new processors from NVIDIA. Probably the biggest news that was happening this week is that Apple is going to be updating the MacBook Pro line. This information came from Bloomberg. They claim that Apple is going to release a thinner MacBook Pro at WWDC in June. It's going to feature a high-resolution display, the latest Intel Ivy Bridge processors, and be pre-installed with macOS 10 10.8 Mountain Lion. And we've kind of been hearing this rumor that Apple might also at WWDC announce availability of Mountain Lion, which I think is going to be a little bit early. I figured they'd bring it out toward the end of the summer. If it does show up in June, that would be kind of a nice surprise. But on the MacBook Pro side, they are expected to move from the AMD GPUs to an NVIDIA GeForce GT650M. And once again, we saw some Geekbench scores surface that seem to support the fact that there's a new MacBook Pro model floating around out there. This one's designated as MacBook Pro 9,1, and it did show an Ivy Bridge quad-core i7 processor. We've also been getting some reports from 9to5Mac to further corroborate the fact that there might be some new MacBook Pros. They say a 15-inch model is due to be released, that it's going to be thinner than the current designs, but not quite as thin as the MacBook Air line. The one feature from the MacBook Air they're saying it will gain is that they're going to move the power button from being on the case onto the keyboard. The other thing that they're reporting on is the ports that are going to be on the new models. They say there's going to be two USB ports, two audio in and out ports, and a battery meter on the left-hand side of the model, and then two Thunderbolt ports, or potentially two Thunderbolt-sized ports, I guess is how they reference it, and an SD card slot plus another USB port on the right-hand side. The interesting thing to note is that it seems to lack a built-in Ethernet port, and that there's no reference to FireWire being on the new models. So I don't know if Apple's expecting everybody to buy adapters if they need hardwired Ethernet. That's how they handle it on the MacBook Air. They do sell an adapter. I think it's a USB to Ethernet adapter. And then on the FireWire side, I'm assuming you could get some Thunderbolt adapters, although technically they're not really adapters. We had this conversation. I had this conversation with Dave Hamilton from the Mac Geek Gab, that really the Thunderbolt, what it gives you is almost like an external PCI card slot. So it's almost like plugging in a FireWire card. So it's a little more complicated than just being a simple adapter. You actually have to have some electronics in there. And right now, I think there's a few Thunderbolt to FireWire converters showing up, or external cards showing up. I don't know what we're gonna call these things, but they are showing up on the market, but they are relatively expensive. So if you need to plug in, this could be a problem if you want to upgrade and you need to plug in older FireWire devices. But that's not confirmed yet. That's sort of on the fence whether or not the new models will have built-in FireWire. I hope they go one more generation, and maybe there was some confusion with that Thunderbolt port. Maybe it's a Thunderbolt port plus a FireWire 800 port. But, you know, if they're trying to squeeze the thinness out of there, there just might not be enough room. Now, the one thing that 9to5 does speculate on, and I was a little bit surprised by, was that these new models would have USB 3 ports, 3.0 ports, and not USB 2 ports. It would be the first Mac, they would be the first Macs to feature that port, and it makes sense because the new Ivy Bridge technology does support that right out of the box, so it'd be easy for Apple to implement, and it's probably just the next evolutionary step. They might as well go to USB 3. It keeps them in line spec-wise with other PC laptops that are out on the market. And I think by now it's just sort of time to move to USB 3. It's backwards compatible with 2.0, and I don't think that it's going to take away from the Thunderbolt ports. And it gives Mac users a little bit more flexibility when they're out there buying hard drives. And, you know, more and more hard drives are showing up on the market, or external peripherals are showing up on the market that are USB 3 and not USB 2. So that's a good thing. The other supporting evidence for this is that in macOS 10.7.4 and macOS 10.8 Mountain Lion betas, they both show potential support with some of the strings that are in there for USB 3 on the Mac. So I think it's coming, man. It would make sense that this might be the first model that we see it in. And related to this, the only other rumor we had this week surrounding Macs was that the MacBook Air next generation models might also get an update where the USB ports move from 2.0 to 3.0 ports. And that's it for the Mac rumors. But at least we have Mac rumors, right? It's nice to see some Macs making their way into the news in the past week. Of course, though, we can't get out of here without some iOS stuff. iOS 6 seems to be getting ready for its debut. 9to5Mac has several reports of some early sightings of iOS 6. They say app developers are beginning to see hits referencing the new operating system in their App Store app usage logs. When those hits happen, it typically means that Apple is doing some internal testing. Actually, some of the developers reported seeing hits of iOS 6 in their app usage logs as far back as April. The common thought is that Apple is in internal testing in advance of WWDC, and there's many who believe that that might be the first place that Apple chooses to show off the new operating system. There's also been some other iOS 6 indicators out there. Code strings were recently found on the iCloud.com beta website. Also, I think some application icons. It looks like Apple plans to add notes and reminders support into the iCloud.com website, and some icons showed up on the beta website in the background of the beta website, I believe, indicating that. One of the biggest changes, though, for iOS 6 that is being reported is that Apple is expected to officially drop Google Maps as the mapping system on the next generation operating system in favor of their own thing. Apple already is using OpenStreetMaps data in iPhoto on iOS, and they had acknowledged that, I think, last week when it was originally released. It was speculated, but Apple hadn't officially acknowledged it. They did push out an update, and in the about information for the application, it does make reference to the fact that they are using OpenStreetMaps data. But for the iOS 6 update, it's expected that Apple will go fully with their own technologies. If you remember, Apple acquired three different mapping companies over the last few years, PlaySpace, Poly9, and C3 Technologies. Apple has a long way to go, or has a big challenge, I guess I should say, in matching the robustness of the mapping system that Google's delivered, but I think they can actually pull it off with these three companies and the technologies that they acquired along with the engineering talent. And as a matter of fact, what we're hearing about the new mapping system is that it's going to feature some impressive 3D modeling technology, and that's stuff that they likely leveraged from the stuff they acquired from C3. If you go out and do some Google searching on C3 Technologies, you can see how impressive their 3D maps are. And that's supposed to make its way or make its debut in iOS 6. So that'll be cool to see. Some of the other features and technologies that are expected in iOS 6, some are reporting that they're expecting major changes to the home screen functionality. I don't think that's likely to happen. I think Apple's going to stick with the look that they have. It works, and I don't see any major reason to change it. I know a lot of jailbreakers in the jailbreak community like to do different things with what's called the springboard, but I don't see Apple making any major changes on that front. They could always surprise me, though. The other updates that are expected are some big updates related to iCloud and its integration into iOS. Specifically, there are reports that Apple is going to update the sharing and commenting features related to photos, so you'll be able to do more of that sort of thing with your images as you share them out. You'll be able to have more of the Flickr and Facebook kind of functionality, but built into iCloud sharing for your photos. You know, like you have an iPhoto now where if I publish photos on Flickr or publish photos on Facebook directly out of iPhoto, people can comment on them and then I can see those comments in my Photos applications. The other thing that's expected is video syncing through iCloud. And at first I thought this meant like syncing of my purchased content, which we already have through iTunes. So if I buy a movie on iTunes, you know, I can download that on my other devices. But no, that's not what they're talking about. This is more like photo stream, but for your videos. So if you take a video on one device it will automatically be synced over to your other devices and vice versa, and you can share those around. And I'm hoping if Apple enables that feature, maybe they give us a little bit more free storage, or maybe this is a way to get us to have to buy a little bit more storage and for Apple to make some money. But who knows? But I would assume we get to see a little peek at what is in iOS 6 at WWDC in just a couple weeks. And then, you know what? DigiTimes just won't let it go. They're still holding out hope that there is a 7-inch iPad. And as a matter of fact, they're even saying we're going to see it this year. They say Apple's going to release a 7 or 7.85-inch iPad in the fourth quarter of this year. The latest version of their rumor says that the touch panels on the mini iPad are going to use a GF2 thin film touch technology. That's versus the current film touch technology that is used in the devices that are glass plus film plus film. GF2 is just glass plus film, so getting rid of one of those films. And so the supposed advantage of that is that it enables you to make thinner panels. They're also a little bit clearer in terms of the resolution and can be produced at a reduced cost, which is actually going to be something that's going to be significant and important if, as the rumor says, the price target for the mini iPad is in the $200 to $250 US range. Screen resolution is also said to be 1024 by 768, which would be the same resolution as the iPad and the iPad 2. That would make things in terms of development a little bit easier for developers. They wouldn't have to recode their apps. There is also one hint out there, or one rumor out there, I guess I should say, that is saying the screen resolution could be 2048 by 1536. Now, that's the same screen resolution as the iPad 3, but shrunk down into 7 inches. That would mean it would yield a true, I guess there's no true Retina resolution. I was going to say true Retina resolution, but would yield a Retina resolution of 326 pixels per inch, which is actually the same Retina resolution as the iPhone 4S. So once again, that would be great if Apple can cram that many pixels in, but in that small of a display at that price point, I would really doubt that. That would be a costly display. But again, it wouldn't require developers to kind of recode their apps. So I think no matter what, if Apple does come out with a smaller form factor iPad, they can't create another screen resolution that developers are going to have to code to. Well, I guess technically they could, but I just don't think that would be a great move because it just overly complicates things. But I still don't put a lot of stock in a 7-inch iPad rumor. Maybe it's just me. And again, I'm going to be proven wrong because the reality is, I think eventually this product hits. I just don't know that it happens this year. I think it's going to take for current iPad sales to really slow down and for the 7-inch tablet market to really come up before Apple decides to jump into that game. But that's just my opinion. You're always welcome to share yours. Please give me your feedback. MacCast@gmail.com. And that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, and that's VMware, makers of VMware Fusion 4 for Mac. You know, if you have to run Windows apps, and some of us do, you don't want the experience of having to kind of switch between screens if you have a Mac and a PC on your desk, or you don't want to go through rebooting. You know, it just, you want a seamless experience, and VMware Fusion 4 gives you that ability. And the latest version has over 90 new features, but most importantly, it integrates so tightly with Mac OS X. Specifically OS X Lion, you get all of your built-in user interface features. So you can do things like use Mission Control with your Windows apps. You can go into full screen mode. You can even have support for gestures. It's really designed to give you the best Windows experience on a Mac, and I think that comes because it's a Mac-like experience, but I may personally be a little bit biased. And the other thing is that it's, I think, priced right. It's just $49.99. If you use the code MACCAST at checkout, you also get another 10% off. So that's a deal just for MacCast listeners. Use the code MACCAST, you're going to get 10% off the $49.99 price, so it's even cheaper. And they even have a free trial available. So if you want to try it out, you can do that, or you can just make a purchase over at vmware.com/Mac. And a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. On a recent episode of the MacCast, I gave a tip on how to create a special email group entry in your contacts application that will allow you to send out emails to an entire group of people on your iOS device using Mail. On macOS 10 desktop, it's really easy because in address book, you can set up a group. And then when you're composing a mail in the to field, you can just enter that group name. And it will send the email out to that entire group. On iOS, you don't have that ability. You can go in and you can select the group from the contacts, but then you have to add each name individually. And this tip helped work around that. Well, a few people emailed me to tell me about an iOS application that you can buy on the App Store called MailShot. They actually have a free version and a paid version. And it does essentially the same thing. What it does is it helps you create the special entry in your contacts that uses like the comma-separated email list. In essence, the tip that I gave out on that episode where you could do it manually on your own, this kind of gives you a little wizard to walk you through it. It makes the process much simpler, but I tried it out prior to my segment and discovered that it was doing, in essence, the same thing. And while they do have a free version of MailShot that allows you to create groups with 5 addresses in each group for free, if you want to do more than that, you have to update to the pro version, which costs $4. So I made the call not to mention the application, but enough people emailed me about it. So I figured, you know, I should probably share the information with you. If you only have to make mail groups or group emails with just 5 people in each list, then you can go ahead and use it. And you could combine them together. So if you had 15 people in a mailing list, you could use the free version to create, you know, group 1, group 2, group 3, and then bring those in and mail to each one of those. A little bit of a hassle, and $4 isn't too much to spend either if you need to upgrade to the pro version. But the reality is, if you follow the tips that I gave you on that episode, you can go in and you can do this on your own, and you don't need to buy a special app. So it just depends on the type of person you are. If you're more of a hands-on person, use my tip. If you prefer something with a graphic user interface, something that walks you through the process and makes it really easy, you might want to check out this MailShot app. It's funny, even after doing this podcast for so many years, I am surprised at how I still don't know what kind of topics are going to actually generate a lot of response from you. And that happened last week when I covered the segment on deleting podcasts on your iOS device. And then we had a listener who wanted to be able to delete on his device and then have that sync back to his iTunes. And probably the most common bit of feedback that I received was that, you know, syncing is a complicated thing, and you generally need to kind of have a single sync source, so it might not make sense to actually delete on the iOS device and have it delete back in iTunes. Basically, a lot of feedback like this from Bob.
Hello, I was just listening to your podcast this week about the user who wants his deleted podcast or video on his iPhone to also be deleted from iTunes. I think that it's a little more complicated. There's really two things going on. One is it currently set to sync with the iPhone? And then should it be deleted from the iTunes library? Deleting something from the iTunes library, I think, is a little more of a severe step. I think, if anything, what a delete operation on your phone should really represent is, I no longer want this item synced to the phone, but please don't delete it from my iTunes library. Or perhaps there should be a setting somewhere in the music app or the video app that says, when I delete, I want it deleted from the source, or I just want to disconnect my sync instruction from the source, or something to that effect. Anyway, love your show. Keep up the good work. Thanks.
Yeah, Bob, I think I see your point on that. You know, just to be able to say, look, I'm deleting this from my device. Go ahead and don't sync it back on this one, whether I listen to it or not, but leave it in my iTunes library. That would make a lot of sense in this instance. The other thing that I kind of thought about is they could do something through iCloud syncing to make this feature possible. Another way to handle it might be to just finally allow podcasts to be managed through iCloud. So when I sync up my podcasts, have them in my iCloud library, and then I wouldn't even need to sync them necessarily to my device. I could just stream them directly down and then remove them. And when I remove them, it could leave them in iCloud, but just remove them on the device again, just like you're saying there, not sync it back to the device. So I got a lot of feedback like that from Bob. The other kind of common feedback that I received was like this one from Brendan.
Hey, Adam, I love the show. This is Brendan. I just wanted to have a reply to a gentleman in the last episode had a problem deleting podcasts off his iDevice and having it sync back. The solution that I use is to, if I don't want to listen to a podcast, or I'm halfway through it and I don't want to listen to the rest of it or whatever, or I just know that I don't want to listen to it at all, I will actually start playing it and then take the progress bar at the top all the way to the end, and it marks it as read, and then or listened to, played. And then it won't delete it immediately, and I don't delete it, but then once I sync with iTunes, it it marks it as read, or played, sorry, in iTunes, and then automatically deletes based off of my my default settings of deleting after they're played. So that's my solution. I hope that helps. And thanks for the show. Love it.
Hey, you're welcome, Brendan. And yeah, that's in essence what we were talking about on the last show. I do like the tip that if you just need to get one off of your device and you don't want to listen to it at all, just, you know, move the slider forward. But it does rely that you go into iTunes and set those settings like you mentioned, and like I mentioned on that prior episode, you have to have it set up to say, hey, and only sync to my device the listened to or not listened to podcasts. And I think that's in a way what Bob was kind of referring to as well, you know, that you have this master sort of library, and then there's some syncing rules that control how or what gets moved on to or taken off of your device. And that's how Apple has it set up to work. And I guess they want us to play in their playground. You know, the other option on this that I just thought of right now is that you could use one of the third-party podcast apps and just do streaming. If you use Instacast or Downcast or something like that, you can choose to just stream directly to your device, and you could just manage your podcasts directly on your device and not have to worry about any of the syncing. You could even download those, and I believe in those applications, because you download it directly from the server, when you delete it, it deletes it out of the application and you don't have the file there. So you don't even have to deal with syncing at all. You just always have access to your podcast as long as you have access to an internet connection. So that could be a third option to kind of work around this. But if you want to just live in the iTunes world, you kind of have to do it Apple's way. And so as I mentioned at the top of the show here, I was able this week to sit down with David Sparks, Mac Sparky. He goes by online, MacSparky.com is his website, but many of you probably know him or might know him from the Mac Power Users podcast, which he does with Katie Floyd on the 5x5 network. He's been on this podcast before talking about different workflow things, just a smart guy, and also an author. He's written a couple books, iPad at Work, Mac at Work, and now just this week he released his own self-published iBook, and it was done with iBooks Author, which is really cool. I did a MacCast member episode with him on that whole process, on how and what it was like to actually produce a book that you're going to sell in the iBook store using the iBook Author tool. So if you're a MacCast member, check that out. It was a very interesting process. I was very curious about that myself. But I wanted to get him on this show because his new book is all about going paperless and paperless workflow and getting rid of, you know, all your file folders full of paper and stuff like that, and getting it all onto your Mac. And so I thought it would be a great opportunity to have him give us kind of his top five tips on going paperless. So here's my conversation with David Sparks. Hey, David, how you doing?
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, thanks for coming back on the MacCast. I'm excited to talk to you because you have a new project that you just finished up and just launched on the iBookstore. Yeah. You want to tell everybody what's going on?
Yeah, I self-published my first book. I'm starting a new series called The Mac Sparky Field Guides, and the very first one is called Paperless. And it's all about tools and workflows to finally go paperless. And it covers things you need for the Mac, the iPad, and the iPhone. And it lays it out in a really nice flow and recommendation. And I used all of those whiz-bang tools in the iBooks Author app. So it's got an hour and a half worth of screencasts and movies. So whatever I tell you about, Ellie, can you read the words? You can look over my shoulder and watch me do them on my Mac or my iPad or my iPhone.
That That is awesome. That is really cool. I've actually gotten to see the book, and it's amazing. It's amazing what you've done with it. And, you know, I think we've talked off mic that, you know, this is kind of the new way of presenting this kind of content. I think we both kind of think this is the way it's going, right?
Yeah, as a technical writer, I am completely spoiled by this. I don't know if I can write a dead tree book again, because not being able to screencast to my readers is going to really make me feel like my hands are tied behind my back.
Yeah, yeah. And this is a great topic for you, the first one. I know we've done some shows on the going paperless stuff, and that's sort of why I wanted to get you on. Now that this is out and sort of fresh in your mind, I thought maybe I could coax you into giving us sort of maybe five tips on going paperless. Obviously, we can't deliver everything you deliver in the book, but people can go check that out and to fill in the blanks. But so, you know, if you had to sort of pick five top things about going paperless, what would those be?
Well, let me see. Just five. Okay.
Five.
Yeah. Pick the PDF is your friend. I think that's the first thing. You need to get your files into a format that's going to be readable in 10 years.
Yeah.
And something that's multi-platform that can go to the iPad or the Mac or a PC, God forbid, right?
Mm-hmm.
PDF, I think, is the one. That's a tip.
I think that's really good. That's really good advice. That's,
well, you know,
that's what I've chosen for my workflow. I don't know what other format would make sense.
Well, some people like try to use JPEG or TIFF, and I guess those kind of work, but I just don't think it's smart. Another really good tip is get yourself a document scanner. You know, if you're going to get serious about going paperless, you need a scanner that can really chew through paper. And if you're trying to do it with an old flatbed scanner that, you know, takes 2 minutes to scan the one side of one page, you're eventually going to give up, because it's just going to take so long and seem so tedious that it's just not going to be worth it to you. So
yeah, you're not going to do it at that point. Yeah, I can honestly say from experience, I tried this at one point. I was like, I'm going to go paperless, and I only had this old Canon flatbed scanner. It lasted all of about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
And then I just said, you know what, I'm going to save my pennies. And I think about 6 months later, I bought a Snap Scan or a Scan Snap. Yeah. I can never get that name right, by the way.
Scan Snap, those are great scanners. They do sponsor my podcast, so I guess I should say that. But I bought their stuff long before that ever happened.
Yeah.
Another good one is the Neat scanners. I think mm-hmm. those are pretty good. There's several companies out there making good scanners, but you need to get a good, you know, honest to goodness document.
Get an auto feeder. That's good advice too.
Another good tip is, you know, paperless isn't just taking the paper you receive in the mail and getting into your computer. It's also taking the digital files on your computer and putting them into your paperless system. Because, for instance, if you get an email that's from Amazon saying, you know, congratulations, you just ordered a new, you know, mm-hmm. Chrome case set, whatever, you got to get that out of a mail file. You're not just going to save the mail message. You got to get that into your paperless records, and you need to, you know, print it out to PDF, which is very easy to do on the Mac. In fact, I show some really cool tricks in the book about how to do that. Another big tip is naming your files right. And, you know, you do need to have a naming convention for this stuff, or you're going to go crazy. And you need to figure it out before you start your paperless system, because it's a lot harder to fix those things after you get rolling. And I have a couple I recommend in the book. There's a lot you can talk about that. I think you incorporate dates. I kind of incorporate a poor man's tagging system into the way I name files.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is, you pick one and you stick with it. And
yeah, I'm guilty of violating this one. And after reading your book, I went, oh man, I blew that one.
Well, you just turn the page and you just pick one and you just go with it.
Yeah.
Once you get it sorted out, and listen, the reason I could write this book is because I've made every mistake. You know, I've learned all this stuff the hard way.
But that becomes important. I mean, it makes searchability, especially with something like Spotlight system wide, or, you know, to be able to dive in. I think that really helps when it comes down to when you need to go back and find this stuff. It can make it that much easier. I mean, you can get to it other ways because of some of the OCR and things that happen, but, you know, if you just know, hey, it's from this year and it was related to this, you can get 90% of the way there a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Just from the file name.
And the last big tip I would say is, when you start this, think about how you want to store and locate your documents. There's a lot of options ranging from something, you know, low tech like nested folders to fancy pants tagging or, you know, some kind of third party app that does it all for you. And all of those options exist on the Mac, and there's good solutions for all those options. And I went through them in the book, and I kind of talked about those and how they fit with cloud storage versus local storage. So that's a tip that really requires a lot more kind of.
Right. Well, let me ask you just to expand on it slightly, because one thing I would wonder about is sort of what are some of the sort of key factors as you're evaluating? Because there are a lot of options out there. So, you know, if you're looking at some of the different bits of software, what would you say two or three of the sort of key critical things that you need to have in sort of a, I'm assuming what we're talking about here is like document manager, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And like a nested folder system is by nature not a document manager app, just it's a group of folders. And like Right. You'd have one that says records, and under that you'd say utilities, and under that you'd have one that says gas bill and one that says phone bill, you know, and you'd copy those electronic records into the relevant folders. That system is very portable. It's kind of timeless because you're not dependent on a third-party developer continuing to make software to support it.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be a real pain in the keister if you've got to drag files to each individual folder. It becomes front-loaded. And you don't want a system, you know, you have to think about what are you going to get out of a paperless system. You don't want to spend, you know, 8 hours a month, you know, filing documents when you only spend 10 minutes a month looking for documents. Then you're not, it doesn't make sense. But there's some tools like Hazel I cover in the book, a large extent, that takes the drudgery out of a nested folder system so you can actually do one. Tagging is the same thing. Tagging can be a really great way to find folders, but you've got to, or a great way to find documents, but you've got to have a reliable system for adding tags to the documents. And there's some really great apps for that, like Default Folder X lets you put tags in, and there's some apps in the Mac App Store that let you put tags in, and there's different tagging formats, you know. So I kind of cover those, and so kind of give you the best, what I think the best in breed is to pull that off. And then there's third-party apps, and probably one of the best ones, I think, is the Neat Scanner app. They have their own proprietary software that will look at a receipt and figure out where the receipt's at and how much it is and what day it is that you bought, you know, you bought spicy carrots on January 12th at Target, you know.
Yeah, for $5. That's the one that I use with my Fujitsu scanners. I don't even use the Neat scanners, but it's the one I kind of fell on. Although, you know, to be honest, I like it a lot, but I don't know that it's the perfect one. I think I'm still looking for the perfect third-party solution. So, you know, again, reading through your book, I had kind of thought about the nested folder system, but I think I really hadn't thought it through and thought about some of the automation, and that's why I ended up with a third-party solution.
Yeah.
I think both are right answers, depending upon what your needs are, but, you know, in hindsight now, knowing what I know, it's sort of like, hey, maybe I could have gotten away with a folder system and it would have worked for me.
Yeah. And that's the point of the book, is to really get you in and see, give you the benefit of my experience with this stuff. And so you can make an educated decision up front.
Yeah.
And like, you know, there's some stuff with Hazel that's like witchcraft. I mean, you can have a look at inside the file and name it and file it for you. It does some great stuff, and I screencast it all that. But I know a lot of people who like, you know, just a third-party application, scan the document and forget it. Or, you know, another thing people do, and I cover this in the book too, is Evernote. You know, Evernote does OCR on PDFs if you've got a paid account, and people just scan it into Evernote and forget about it. And they do fine finding it later because Evernote's indexed it for them. Right. So
gives you the advantage if you get some backup in there too, which is another whole nother topic. But we're not going to dive into that. We're going to leave that for the book. And if people want to check that out, they can get deeper. I certainly appreciate you coming on real quick and just sharing some of the quick tips, just so people can find it easily. Where do they go to get the book, and what's it called? Remind them, and pricing and all that sort of stuff.
Sure. The book is $5. I priced it aggressively because I'm really passionate about this and I want a lot of people to see it. So please go check it out. You can get it from your iPad in the iBook store. If you just go to the store tab and type paperless, you should find it. If you're on your Mac, you can also find it in iTunes in the bookstore or the iTunes store. If you just search paperless or David Sparks. You cannot find it from your iPhone because it doesn't play on the iPhone because it uses all this fancy stuff. It doesn't work on the iPhone, so you can't even search it on the iPhone, which is causing some confusion for people I know. And that's it. Those are the two places you can find it. Eventually, for people who are outside the markets that the iBookstore supports, it's currently for sale in 30 countries. It'll be 32 very quickly after this thing airs. But for people who are outside those markets or don't have an iPad, probably within a month or so, I'm going to have a PDF version. Although I recommend getting it on the iPad if you can. I make less money if you buy it on the iPad, but I just think it's so much of a better experience. You should do it.
Cool. And then also, I guess people have heard you on the show before. I mean, I've been podcasting for a long time, but you also do a podcast that covers a lot of this kind of content and things like that. You want to tell everybody what that is and where they can find that?
Yeah, it's a Mac Power User, so I have the pleasure of podcasting with Katie Floyd. We're trying to get these shows out almost once a week, but not always. And in fact, we just are releasing a show on paperless as well. You know, surprise, surprise, right? So you can learn more about paperless from that as well if you just go over to Mac Power Users. And it's macpowerusers.com. And then I also blog at macsparky.com. And that's kind of my home. So you can find anything I'm up to there. And you'll find links to the book there as well.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you, David, again for coming on and chatting with us.
And thanks for having me on, Adam. It's always great talking to you.
There you go, David Sparks. I hope you found those tips useful. I know I did. You know, when I went to my paperless workflow, just knowing those little kind of where to start sort of things is incredibly useful. And I appreciate David sharing his thoughts on it with us. And if you want to know more about that topic, definitely check out his book. I mean, it's $5 in the iBookstore. You can't go wrong. It's just a great deal. And like he said, there's an hour and a half or over an hour and a half of video tutorials in there, along with the text and the step-by-step and all of that stuff. It really is an incredible new format. And even if you just want to see what an iBooks authored book looks like, a good example of it, it's a great example of how to do it right. And also be sure to check out his podcast if you haven't heard him before. And he's just a really smart guy, and I love having him in our Mac community. So we'll get him on again sometime in the future. We may be a little bit late for this tip, but I guess we're getting toward the end of spring, beginning of summer. Something a lot of us like to do around this time of year is spring cleaning, right? We have that term for a reason. It seems stereotypical, but you know, spring cleaning, and part of that might be cleaning off some of the files and old data and stuff on your Mac. And I got a question this week, an email. Someone had asked about how do I clean out duplicate files throughout my operating system? And as I was reading through the question and kind of thinking about this, you know, I thought, well, basically, you have kind of three options and you have three areas where you're likely going to have to deal with duplicate files. And so your three options generally are that you just go through by hand and manually remove duplicate files and try and find them and ferret them out and locate them. You might be aided a little bit by search or filtering to help along with that. The other option is to use some sort of third-party tool to clear stuff out. And then the third option, if you know command line and you know how to do grep and awk and some of these really cool command line tools, you probably can open up the terminal and do some really sophisticated command line mojo and search for stuff and find duplicates on your system and remove them. Using the terminal can be incredibly powerful, and I will tell you, it also can be very intimidating and potentially dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. So, you know, if you make an error in the terminal, everything can go south and you can really mess up your operating system. Just ask Pixar. I saw in the threads this week, there was a story on Pixar and how somebody had accidentally deleted all of the files for Toy Story 2 using a terminal command, and they almost didn't get them back because they hadn't verified their backup and the backup was corrupted. I haven't read the whole story yet, but it obviously came out okay because they got the movie back, but they almost lost a year's worth of work. So that's the kind of thing that you can do if you don't know what you're doing in the terminal, if you get a path wrong or something like that. So I think it goes without saying, for any of these deduplicating methods, make sure you have a full backup of all your data before you proceed with any of these. I'm not really going to get into the terminal stuff because we could do a whole program on that. I'm going to cover the other two ways of sort of finding duplicate files. And then as I mentioned, there's kind of three areas we'll probably want to find duplicates in. And one would be just in the Finder, our documents and files and folders and stuff like that. Another place is iTunes, your music files. And then the third place is going to be, I'm going to cover your iPhoto library. If you use Aperture, it might be Aperture for you, but basically your photo library. And these are kind of the three main points or areas I would kind of focus on. And so starting with the Finder, I think, you know, kind of doing it manually, the best way to do that is to use Spotlight and maybe use some search criteria and filtering. If I were doing it, I would use the Finder search, the actual, you know, when you hit Command F or you go in the Finder and you choose Find Files, bring up the Finder dialog, search dialog window, and start doing your searching in there. And what you could do to do your filtering is use search tokens or use the search parameters to kind of filter down your results. So I'll just give you one example. Say you wanted to find some duplicate PDFs. So what I would start out doing is entering the search token kind:PDF, or just use the search parameter, click the little plus button, and say where file type is PDF or kind is PDF. And that'll give you a result with all of the PDFs. You know, make sure that your entire hard drive is selected, or if you know all your PDFs are stored in a certain folder, maybe your documents folder in your home folder, select that as your starting point. You know, you can do this in little blocks, or you can do your whole entire hard drive. It would work either way. But, you know, enter in that criteria. That's going to give you a result of all your PDFs. And then sort the column by size to kind of group together the PDFs that are of the same size. And that's going to narrow down where you might find your duplicate matches, right? This two files that are the same size are likely not always going to be duplicate files, but they have a better chance of being the same file. And then along with that, then you can kind of pull out and see where the file size is the same and the names are the same. They should show up right next to each other in those search results. And then I would also make sure that you have the path bar turned on in the Finder. So go under the Finder menu, under View, and make sure Show Path Bar is checked before you start your search. And that way, when you find the duplicate files, you can click on it in the Finder and you can see where it's located. Because you might have duplicate files strewn across your system, and maybe you know what, I want to keep the one that's in my documents folder, but the one that I archived off someplace else, or the one that is over in the mail downloads folder, you know, that's a common place. If you've opened up a mail attachment, it can create a copy of that file in the mail attachment downloads folder, or whatever that thing is called. I can't remember the specific name of it, but your duplicate might be in there. And so that will probably be the one you want to delete. You don't want to delete the one in your documents folder. So you can find stuff that way, just doing search and filtering and use various combinations of those tricks. For the Finder method, I have to tell you, it's very tedious. It's very manual, but it works, and I think is potentially safer because you have the ability to hand review each duplicate and kind of inspect it. You can use Quick Look to open it up, make sure it is an exact duplicate. You can do some things before you delete it, but it will take you a lot longer. So because of that, I think a lot of people turn to some of the third-party applications that are out there to help sort of guide you and help you find duplicates. I think underlying these tools, it's a lot of the same techniques. They use a little bit more sophistication, more along the lines of the stuff you could do yourself if you really knew terminal commands and command line. The prices on deduping apps in the Mac App Store, I just did a quick little search. They really range from a couple bucks all the way up to $10, $20, $30, $40 in some cases. The key thing when you're looking at them is I think you want to find one that has a good, simple, clean user interface, one that also has the ability to review what you're deleting before it just actually goes in and expunges it, because you don't want to accidentally delete something, and one that has a bunch of different options for sort of setting up the matching criteria. And one key one on the matching criteria I would look for is make sure you find a deduper that has the ability to do what is called like a bit-by-bit or sort of a checksum match to verify that the two files are basically identical. What it does is it looks at the core file data, you know, the bits, and makes sure it's a one-to-one match. And when it does that, it's fairly safe to assume that that's exactly the same file. And so two applications that I've run across and people have recommended to me, I haven't personally used any of these, so they don't have my seal of approval per se, but I've tried them out here and there, and they seem to do a pretty nice job. ADC ACDC, excuse me, ADCC or ACDC duplicate finder is one of them, and Gemini 2 is the other one. And I'll have links to all these that I mentioned in the show notes up at maccast.com, so don't worry about writing them down. You can get them there. But those are two that you might want to take a look at. I'm sure there's some others. If you have recommendations on any of the apps that I'm going to recommend in this segment, stuff I don't mention, please send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Let me know if you found a tool that's particularly useful to you. But those are kind of the two Finder-based ones that I've run across that people have recommended. So that kind of covers the Finder. Now, looking at iTunes, generally with iTunes, you want to make sure that you use iTunes or iPhoto to find the duplicates. So this goes for iTunes and iPhoto, I guess. You don't want to find those duplicates directly in the Finder. Like, you don't want to be deleting images or audio files directly out of, say, the music folder or your iPhoto library folder. And the reason for that is because iTunes and iPhoto and Aperture, these are library apps. And if you delete stuff in the Finder from those applications, the apps themselves, the library files, aren't going to get updated and not going to know that you deleted information out of it. And you're going to end up with broken links, and cleaning that up can be particularly tricky and troublesome. And it's just something you don't want to bother with. So when you are wanting to dedupe iTunes, Aperture, anything with a library file, you're going to want to do it from within the application. So in the case of iTunes, go ahead and launch iTunes. And iTunes actually has a built-in sort of duplicate finder. It's not the best in the world, but it might be enough, depending upon what your needs are. It might be enough to get you going, or to at least allow you to clean up your library. And this is, once again, more of a manual process. And I do find when I use it, I get a lot of false positives, but I'll give you a little tip that might help eliminate some of those false positives. But the way this works is, in iTunes, go into your iTunes library, and then select the library that you want to find duplicates in. So this could be your music library, your podcast library, your movies library. It could even be a specific playlist, something like that. And then in the iTunes file menu, select display duplicates. And this is for the latest version of iTunes. I think it was similar for other versions, but the find duplicates item, if you're using an older version of iTunes, might be in a different spot. So just be aware of that. But in the latest version, it's under the file menu and you say display duplicates. And then once you've done that, it's going to filter whatever you have selected down and just show you what it thinks the duplicate files are. And then at that point, you can use the columns, turn on and off different columns. I like to turn on the bitrate column so that when I find a duplicate song, I can make sure I delete the lower bitrate version and not the highest bitrate version. So that's helpful. But then I'll sort by like the song name or the track name. That'll group the tracks together, and then I can see, oh, okay, this is the one that is the lower bitrate. Go ahead and delete that. So you can use the different columns and the different sorting on the different columns to kind of group things together and figure out which is the one you want to keep and then which is the one you want to delete. And then you just simply select it and hit delete to delete that from your iTunes library. I think it'll ask you if you want to move it to the trash. You can hold down the option key if you want to skip some of those dialogues. But then you can go through and start cleaning up your library. When you're done, don't forget to turn off the display duplicates option, because it's kind of like a toggle. And I've done that in the past where I've been cleaning up my library, displaying duplicates, and then suddenly I'm like, where did all my music go? And that's because I still had display duplicates on. So you'll want to go back under the file menu and choose display all, or you can just click the little display all button that's at the bottom of the window when you have display duplicates turned on. So you can do that manual process. And like I said, it works okay. If you don't have a lot of deduping to do in iTunes, it can probably get you through. But you might also want to turn to a third-party application. And once again, I personally have tried some of these. I've never had much luck using them, but there's a lot of people that really like these applications. And I'm just going to give you two of the more popular ones. There are a lot out there. So once again, if you have one that you've used that you particularly like, then go ahead and let me know. The first one is called TuneUp. from tuneupmedia.com. It's supposed to work really well. I've tried it out. The one thing about TuneUp is their marketing, you'll see it a lot online, and just their website in general too. It, to me, feels a little bit spammy. It seems a little bit fishy in terms of their marketing, but from what I've been told, it is a good tool and it does the job and it does what it says it can do. So you might take a look and try that one. The other application that I ran across is called Dupin, and this one is from Doug Scripts apps, and Doug Scripts is this great resource for Apple Scripts. Been around for a long time. He writes really good stuff. The website's really great. You can get, you know, when I talk to people about Apple Script, I tell them, you know, go to Doug Scripts, and there's a lot of great information and tools and stuff you can use there. So I did try this one out on my Mac as I was prepping for the show, and it seems to do a really nice job. There's a lot of options. There's a lot of options to just sort of mark tracks so that you can go back and review. So it's not going to go through. You can have it automatically go through and remove stuff from your library, but you can also kind of put a lot of checks and balances in as well. And I think you can do that with TuneUp also. But take a look at either one of those. DougScripts.com is where you'll find the Dupin application. And once again, I'll have links to all of these in the show notes at maccast.com. So you can use a third-party tool. For iPhoto, there really is, other than just sort of, if you want to do it manually, going through, launching your iPhoto library and just going through and kind of sorting by name or, you know, the file name or something like that, there isn't really any built-in way in iPhoto to kind of find duplicate files or dedupe files, at least not one that I'm currently aware of. So with that, you really do need to turn to a third-party tool. And one that I've seen demonstrated, I think we had a talk on this at my Mac user group, is one called Duplicate Annihilator. And once again, this is kind of nice because rather than actually deleting duplicates when you go through and use the tool, it automatically finds duplicates and then marks them with a delete reference in the comments. And then once it's all been, you've run the tool and it's sort of identified everything that it thinks is a duplicate, you go into iPhoto and use the search functionality, or you can use a smart album to separate out everything that it thinks is a duplicate and then go ahead and sort of manually review and delete them out of your iPhoto library. So those are kind of a bunch of different ways and methods and techniques that you might use for doing a little bit of spring cleaning on your files in different locations and hopefully kind of removing some duplicates from your system. So I hope you find that useful. And for those of you who sent in that email, I hope that answers your question. We are getting ever closer and closer to the impending closure of MobileMe and the transition over to iCloud. And this week, I actually had a friend call me up, and they have an older system that they cannot move or transition to iCloud. They can run Snow Leopard, but they can't run Lion. So they have a MobileMe account. They have a MobileMe.me email address that they want to keep, they want to continue to use. And so they asked me, you know, what am I going to do? Do I have options? Do I have to go get a Gmail account? Do I have to do something else? And so the question was, what happens to your old MobileMe email accounts when everything transitions over to iCloud? Well, luckily, the one sort of survivor coming out of MobileMe and one that doesn't have to completely transition to iCloud is Mail. Apple will actually let you keep your .me email address even if your system does not support iCloud or Lion. So if you can't upgrade to Lion, you have a .me email and you want to keep it, you just need to follow a couple steps. It's pretty straightforward. You just go to me.com/move and then you'll log in with your MobileMe account information. And then as you're doing the transition, I think it starts to walk you through the iCloud transition, but there should be an option in there that says that you can't upgrade to Lion and therefore can't upgrade to iCloud, and that you want to keep your email address even after MobileMe has ended, you know, after June 30th when it expires, you want to continue to have access to and use your email. So you just go through that, and that should allow you to do that. That said, even if you have a me.com address, if you're not really tied to it, you know, if you don't have everything invested in that email address, now may be a good time to consider migrating or moving to another mail service, transitioning something to something like Gmail. And especially if you have an older Mac that can't run Lion and you can't get on iCloud, and as much as I am sad about this, I was really hoping there's going to be a late-breaking reprieve for at least Snow Leopard users to be able to get on iCloud. Doesn't look like Apple's going to do that. Then you might want to just transition over to Google so that you can do syncing of everything, not just your mail, but maybe do contacts and Google Calendar and things like that, because all of those services from Google will sync up with your Mac. They will sync up with your iOS devices. So you could just totally transition everything you were doing syncing-wise from Mobile Me over into Gmail and Google Calendar and contacts and stuff like that. So that might be a worthwhile alternative if you can't run Lion. If you are invested in your Mobile Me account and still can't run Lion, I did find out this week, and I don't know why I didn't think about this before, that if, at least for Calendar, you can stay with your Mobile Me email and switch to using BusyCal instead of iCal for your calendar. BusyCal is this great alternative application. I really like it because it has the old school iCal interface, you know, where we actually can have our information in a little pane in the sidebar, you know, when you click on an entry in your mail. BusyCal does that, along with a million other features, including some great syncing features for, you know, keeping in sync and sharing calendars over a LAN, a local area network, excuse me. It also, you know, has cool little things like you can get the weekly weather forecast in your calendar. You can add in stickers. It has a lot more customization in terms of fonts and stuff like that. I don't play around with a lot of that stuff, but you have those options available. So it's kind of like, I always call it iCal on steroids. And I've been a big fan and a user for a long time, but now a big advantage is if you're running an older operating system, you can, after the iCloud transition, still sync up your calendars with BusyCal and iCloud, whereas iCal will only sync if you're running Lion. You don't need to do that with BusyCal. BusyCal will run under Leopard, Snow Leopard, or Lion, and you'll have all of your syncing features. And if you want to know more about this, BusyCal has a great article on their FAQ, and I'll link to that in the show notes at mattkess.com on how to get this all set up and switch over. And so you have to buy BusyCal, but at least your calendar syncing will still work, and you can sync with all of your iOS devices and stuff like that. So there is life after Mobile Me, even if you move to iCloud, even if you have an older system. There's some options. And then I have one more item for you today. This time around, it was a question from a listener, and I received this voicemail from Philip.
Hi, Adam. Once again, thank you for the fantastic show. I have a problem that maybe yourself or the Mac community can help with. I live and work at a school camp. My house is above the camp, and my broadband reaches all the way through. Now, what I'd like to do is offer the camp users the use of broadband. There's many reasons I can't have a separate line to it. So what I'd like to do is I've got an old Mac running Tiger, an old PowerPC iMac. And what I'd like to do is leave that down there and let people use my broadband connection. But what I'd like to do is have some way of monitoring it, like an internet cafe, without actually buying iCaf. It's a very expensive piece of software for one user at a time. So what I'm looking for is some free software or a script or anything that would allow me to monitor the broadband usage, restrict the sites that people can go to. I'd like to be able to time it so you only have, you know, 5, 10, 20 minute blocks of access, or 10, 20, 30 megabytes at a time, you know, just like you would at an internet cafe. Any suggestions would be helpful, or, I mean, I might be able to do this all through the security settings on my Mac, but I've never had to use them, so any help would be much appreciated. Keep up the great work. Thank you.
All right, Philip, I'm going to try and help you out. And I think your first inkling was kind of a good place to start for a lot of people. I don't know that it's going to 100% work in your case, but not necessarily the security settings, but what you might want to look into are the parental controls. And I would say even more so if you were running Snow Leopard or Lion, but I don't remember how the parental controls were way back on Tiger, if all of the features that I'm going to talk about were in there. But I was at least able to poke through Lion and see what some of the options are. So if you go into System Preferences and you go into Parental Controls, you can see what options you have. You'd basically set up a new user account, probably a limited access user account for your camp people, and then go in and then you'd want to tweak some of the settings in terms of what areas they could get into, what sites they could access and stuff like that. Even on older systems, you know, it's going to give you some, but not all of the features I think that you're looking for. And Snow Leopard and Lion, for example, for the websites, you could create just a whitelist of websites. That functionality is in there. So you can go in and you can say, you know what, when launching Safari and surfing the web, you can only go to these websites. You block everything except this domain, this domain, and this domain. That can get a little bit tricky in terms of a lot of sites access. You know, you'll load a web page and it might be from maccast.com, but in the background it might be loading resources from other websites. So you, when you're whitelisting, you kind of have to play around with some of the settings a little bit to get it to work 100% the way you want to. But you can, you know, really lock down that system in terms of where someone can surf online. With timed access, unfortunately, the only controls that are built into Mac OS X are relevant to the entire Mac and by time of day and sort of the hours on or off, not a limit of the actual number of minutes or the bandwidth used, which is what I think more what you're looking for. So I don't think that's an ideal scenario for you. But for other people, you can go in and say, look, this user account can only use this Mac between 8 a.m. and noon. And then they can again use it from 4 to 8. And they can only do that weekdays. You can't get access on the weekends. So you can set up those kind of controls in the parental settings. In your case, because you want to limit actual access to the internet, another place you might look is you might check on your router and with your router software, because sometimes in there you can actually limit internet access based on a specific machine or a device using the MAC address. And that's not like, for those people who don't know, that's not the MAC like your Mac. It's the, I think it stands for machine access card. I'm going to get myself in trouble because I don't remember that acronym. But basically what it is that every interface on your Mac in terms of a network interface, be it your airport card or your Ethernet card or your Ethernet port, has a specific ID number called the MAC address. It's unique to that interface. And it identifies that interface, that connection on your network. To the system. So you can use that to block or control access. So you can look, I don't know what kind of router you have, but you can look on there. If you have an Airport Extreme, I'll just give you an example, you can use what's called the timed access controls. So if you go into Applications, Utilities, and launch Airport Utility, and again, I'm going to give you instructions for the current version of Airport Utility. If you have an older version of the Airport Utility, you might need to tweak these instructions a little bit. But go ahead and launch Airport Utility and then select the base station that you want to edit and click the edit button to bring up the settings. And then when the settings panel comes up, go ahead and click on the network tab. And in the network tab, you're going to check the little checkbox that says enable access control. And when you check that, next to it, active will become a timed access control button. When you click on that, it'll bring up another pane. And in there, you can click the plus button to add a new client. And when you do that, a little sheet will come down and you can put a description of the machine. So you could say, you know, downstairs iMac, and then you'll plug in the MAC address, that address for, if it's on wireless, the airport card, or if it's hardwired for the Ethernet card. And if you need to get that information, the way you do that is through the system profiler. So if you hold down the option key and select System Profiler in Snow Leopard or System Information in Lion from the Apple menu, the System Profiler will come up, and then you can select the network, And then in the active services column on the right, you can select the device that's being used to connect that Mac to your network. So again, airport or Ethernet, select whichever one that is. And then in the listing there in the results, you should see the Mac address. And you can copy that and then paste that into the field in the airport configuration. And that'll say, okay, now I want to control access for this specific interface on my network, this specific Mac. And then you can click the little plus button below that once that's set up and then set days and times that that machine is allowed to access the router. And outside those times, that machine won't be able to connect to your network. And so once again, it's not exactly what you're looking for, Philip, because it's not timed control. It's not like saying, oh, this Mac can only use the internet for 30 minutes a day, or you know, it's more, this Mac can use the internet between these hours. So I think for what you're looking for, you're probably going to have to turn to some third-party software. And the one that I'm aware of and people have told me about is Intego Content Barrier. Intego also makes an antivirus application that's pretty good from what I understand. So with all the security concerns, if you've been looking for an antivirus product, they have Intego Virus Barrier. But this is called Content Barrier, and what it allows you to do is do the kinds of things that you're looking for. And it actually is pretty aggressive, or you know, depending on your settings, it can be pretty aggressive about what it's monitoring. So it will let you do full logging of connections, you know, when they were on, when they were off, the total amount of time. You can even go in for different user accounts and record the screen, watch everything that they're doing on that machine. You can do keystroke logging. I mean, real kind of Big Brother stuff if you really want to know what's going on in that system and sort of virtually monitor who's using it. But it will also let you do exactly what you're looking for in terms of limit the internet access based on time of day, based on the number of hours, the number of minutes, based on a total time limit. It will work, but it does require macOS 10.5 or better. So you are going to have to upgrade from Lion to Leopard, but I think your machine will actually run Leopard. So I think it would be an option for you and probably will give you all the functionality you need. Now, it's not cheap, but it might be cheaper than the one product that you mentioned. It's $40 a year for two Macs, so that'll cover two machines, and that's U.S. dollars, of course, so you'll have to do the conversion, but $40 a year for two Macs, and then you'll just have to pay that each year that you want to continue upgrading or using the software. And that's intego.com is the website. And again, I'll have links to that in the show notes at maccast.com. So hopefully that gives you some directions to go in and potentially a solution. If anybody else has recommendations for Philip, please send me feedback. But beyond that, I think that's going to do it for today's episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Furonix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software and get more information and details over at furonix.com. Circus Ponies, check out Notebook. You can get free trials as well as details over at circusponies.com. Smile, they make Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, Text Expander Touch, and PDF Pen for the iPad. You can get information on all of their software as well as Mac trials over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, you know, if you want to get some cash for your old Mac, your old iPhone, your old iPod, you can use Gazelle's service. Just do a simple search. They'll make you an offer after answering a few brief questions, and you can get cash for your old stuff. And you can find information on that over at gazelle.com. And then VMware. If you need to run Windows on your Mac, it should be seamless and easy, and it really is with VMware Fusion. It's $49.99 for the product, but if you use the coupon code MACCAST at checkout, you can save an additional 10%. You can get information and details on the product as well as make your purchase over at vmware.com/Mac. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. A big thank you to you for your support. If you have any feedback for me, a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please send me your feedback. You can send audio comments or emails to maccast@gmail.com. If you'd like to leave voicemail, you can call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9, or you can use Skype. My Skype address is the MacCast, and you can leave voicemail there. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about in this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the MacCast forum. I actually just did an upgrade to the forum, so it's got a little bit of a new look, some new features and things like that. It really has kind of become a community, and I was on there, and there's some great folks over there answering all kinds of questions. So if you need help with Mac, Apple topics, iOS, it doesn't matter. Just head over there and hang out for a little bit. I think you'll find everybody over there very friendly, and it's a lot of fun. So check out the forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the MacCast Facebook community, and that's over at facebook.com/themaccast. And over there, I try and post just fun, quirky little things that I discover as I'm doing research for this show, stuff that normally wouldn't make it into the show, little videos, little tips and tricks, cool new products and stuff like that. I post that stuff over on the Facebook community to share with everybody. So if you're looking for that sort of thing, take a look over there. And that's going to do it for today. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.